Beneath the city of New York are living catacombs, an endless maze of subterranean tunnels, unfit for anything human. Unauthorized for anything experimental.
Hold it! There's something moving up ahead in the tunnel!
And unlikely to bring anyone down there. So... they're coming up. Chud! Chud! Check your basement.
And what you just heard is a clip from the 1984 Horror Cheese Fest Chud, C-H-U-D, which stands for Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers. A true product of its times, Chud is a deliciously trashy B-movie depicting New York City being invaded by an army of, well, cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers, which are yellow-eyed, pointy-toothed atomic mutants that live in the sewers. It's utterly beyond belief, and if you're into that sort of movie, I highly recommend it. Chud is far from the only movie that relies on this seemingly very specific trope. The idea of a separate class of people living in squalor underground, whether they're portrayed as barbaric, or as downtrodden heroes, or as a whole civilization of their own, is surprisingly common, and New York City, in particular, is popular as a setting for these kinds of stories. Besides Chud, media as different as the movie Beneath the Planet of the Apes, the original X-Men comics, the rock opera The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway by Peter Gabriel's original band Genesis, and the Gregor the Overlander series by The Hunger Games author Suzanne Collins, to name a few, all include societies of strange people living under New York. The trope even gets parodied in both The Simpsons and Futurama. Homer gets attacked by Chuds in the episode The City of New York versus Homer.
And that's when the Chuds came at me.
Oh, Homer, of course you'll have a bad impression of New York if you only focus on the pimps and the chuds.
And the sewer dwellers of Futurama's New New York have such a complete civilization that they even have their own sewers, and their own rumors about mutants living in them. I think there are a few reasons why, when people think of an underground race of humans or proto-humans, they tend to situate them under New York City. First, the prospect of any society living undetected away from society at large is inherently unsettling, but all the more so if you juxtapose it against a place that is the opposite of all those things, a place that is bustling and the epitome of civilization. And it's hard to think of a better example of that than New York City. And, as one of the biggest cities in the Western world, it's more likely than anywhere else to be familiar to your audience. And everything is scarier the more familiar the setting is to you. In stories that are more fantasy than horror, like Gregor the Overlander, New York is likewise used as a symbol of the mundane and familiar, as a juxtaposition against the fantastical world under it. In other cases, like Genesis, a British band, singing about a mysterious land under New York, New York becomes the setting for an underground adventure for the opposite reason. To people who aren't from there, New York comes off as bewildering, filthy, and overcrowded. If New York is weird to you, it's not hard to imagine that it might get even weirder underground. But if New York is familiar to you, it's a good starting point for an adventure into another world, or a spine-chilling story that, even if the special effects are trash and the actors are hammier than hamsters, will leave you wondering about what's really lurking under your feet. And of course, everybody knows that there really is a lot under New York. The city's subway system is the most used in the Western Hemisphere. It's the only major American city where most people regularly ride transit. So a quintessential part of being in New York is being under New York, more so than any other American city. East Coast transit buffs love to cite the dismal statistic that New York is the only major city in the world where the transit system was larger during World War II than it is today, meaning that there are large parts of the subway that have been abandoned. What's in those abandoned tunnels? Most of the people who tell urban legends about New York's sewers are full of shit, although the most famous sewer myth, that they're full of alligators, might have a kernel of truth to it. According to none other than the New York Times, in the 1930s, a craze for baby alligators as pets swept the nation, with gators available by mail order for $1.50 in kids' comic magazines. This was not a forward-thinking decision on the part of the pet industry, and as the gators grew to frightening sizes, kids released a handful of them into storm drains. They didn't survive long, and certainly didn't breed, but for a little while, they did terrorize civil engineers, which is really all you need in life. Today, the occasional gator sighting still occurs under New York, but they're effectively a sort of urban Bigfoot at this point. But if there's a kernel of truth to the gators in the sewers story, might there also be a kernel of truth to all the stories about people living under New York? Obviously, New York has a lot of space underground, as well as one of the world's highest rates of homelessness. It wouldn't be surprising to find at least a few homeless people living in some abandoned tunnel under the city, but perhaps there are more than a few, something more in line with the many fictional portrayals of what could be under the streets. Since at least the 1980s, the above-ground homeless in New York have passed around stories of so-called mole people living under the city, who are not to be confused with the Mole people, which is a kick-ass Mexican food cart in East Portland. The New York mole people rumors are too broad and too inconsistent to summarize here, but in the early 90s, LA Times journalist Jennifer Toth decided to investigate. She ended up spending months slogging through abandoned tunnels, interviewing dozens of people about life beneath the city, sometimes protected by cops, sometimes only by the street cred she had gained among the tunnel dwellers. The result was the book, The Mole People, released in 1993 to critical acclaim. What Toth found was striking. On the Chud to Gregor the Overlander spectrum, from barely human flesh-eating mutants to wise, decadent, space opera-ish ancient civilization, New York's mole people are somewhere in the middle. Not only did Toth found far more people living under New York than anyone could have guessed, mostly in subway and commuter rail tunnels rather than the sewers, understandably, the societies of people she found were more organized than anyone expected to. Most of the people Toth met said they lived underground by choice rather than by necessity, and genuinely preferred the tunnels to the city above. Some of them would even have been able to afford apartments if they lived above ground. Some of them were surprisingly educated. Toth met a few people who had college degrees, one who even had a PhD, and many others who, regardless of their formal education, carried around books in the tunnels and were clearly quite well-read. One person had a two-story home in a former subway escape shaft, with stolen furniture and electricity siphoned from the wiring on exit signs and subway communication lines. And staggeringly, in some cases, the mole people even had governments of their own. Deep beneath Grand Central Station, Toth claims to have visited a community of 200 people, led by an elected mayor who had once been a community organizer in Harlem, with a library, a registered nurse, a teacher for the several children who lived down there, and hot showers obtained by illegally tapping into steam and water pipes. The mayor appointed people called runners to supply the community with food gleaned from above-ground shelters and dumpsters outside restaurants, as well as to relay messages between them and other underground communities just like it. The existence of such places was a closely guarded secret even among other tunnel dwellers. Toth only managed to tour the community after months of begging one of her informants. And whenever a homeless person who lived alone in the tunnels got near this strange little town under Grand Central, the runners would blindfold them, lead them through a maze of tunnels, and then remove the blindfold somewhere far away. Even if rumors spread that such a place existed, they wouldn't be able to find it again. Life certainly wasn't easy down in the dark, but it sure was better than being homeless above ground. But it was when Toth's book went even further off the rails, no pun intended, that people began to question just how much of the Mole People could be true. Because the existence of hidden squatter villages with elected mayors was far from the most outrageous thing Toth claimed to have discovered. How much truth is there to stories of organized societies underneath New York City? We'll have to see. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosity. The Mole People, by Jennifer Toth, is a haunting read. Fundamentally, it is a book about urban poverty, and it includes depictions of people in absolutely wretched circumstances. People with all-consuming drug issues, people fleeing from abusive families, people who have lost faith in society's ability to provide for them. But it makes the case pretty well that as bad as life is under the streets, it's better than life on the streets. No, the thing about the Mole People that really sticks with you after you've read it is the notion that nobody really knows how many people live under New York City, or how deep the tunnels go. There's no King of the Mole People. Not that people haven't tried to claim that title, as we'll see. As well organized as some underground communities may be, they aren't united enough for anyone to have a full grasp on who lives down there. In fact, if there's a fictional portrayal of people living under New York that comes closest to Toth's book, it might be the one in Futurama, in which the underground dwellers have amenities of their own, as well as their own rumors of even weirder people living in tunnels below them. Only a few will self-identify as Mole People. Most New York tunnel dwellers tell Toth that the real Mole People are further down, and they're just as mysterious to the near-surface tunnel dwellers as all the tunnel dwellers are to above-ground New Yorkers. A lot of the stories Toth records about the people the Mole People call the Mole People strain credibility, but given what Toth claims to have observed with her own eyes, I'm not sure I can dismiss them outright. Early on in the book, for example, Toth describes the warren of tunnels underneath Grand Central, which, in addition to the closely guarded, secret, orderly little community, includes several levels of abandoned subway and commuter rail platforms that have been built and forgotten over time. There's no complete blueprint, she says. It's like the mines of Moria, right under the feet of 8 million people. There's almost a sense of cosmic horror to it, I feel. The idea that even in a place like New York, or even especially in a place like New York, the closest thing there is to a capital city of the world, there can be vast unknowns no further down into the ground than the height of most of the city's buildings. It's absolutely terrifying to me that there are parts of New York where large numbers of people live that are just cut off from all mainstream society. It's like the universal recurring dream of discovering rooms in your house that you didn't know existed, which, I don't know about you, but I always found to be a profoundly disturbing thought. One tunnel dweller Toth interviewed said he'd lived under Grand Central in a natural cavern that people called the condos. It was a somewhat comfortable, if anarchic, underground community, until the cavern was discovered by transit police and raided. This man had no choice but to move further underground, which led to a chilling experience that I'm just gonna have to quote in full here. The further down you go, the weirder people get. And I mean real weird. There are people down there, man, I swear they have webbed feet. Can't hardly see them at times. They're so sneaky. They make strange noises and sounds, like trains. But they aren't trains. They're communicating with each other. They said I could stay, but that I could only be allowed to go back up with their permission. I ran from that place, man, and I ain't never going back. They're the mole people. Huh. You can almost see Suzanne Collins reading this book and having that exact passage plant the seeds of Gregor the Overlander in her mind. In fact, having read The Mole People, I'm sure Suzanne Collins took inspiration from this book. It's easy enough to say this story may be every bit as much a piece of fantasy as Gregor the Overlander is, except that the two most notable details of the deep underground people, that they communicate with strange, whistling or hooting noises, and that they have webbed feet, are corroborated in slightly different ways by other people Toth talked to. Several chapters on, the homeless outreach worker Harold Daymuse describes a man who he encountered living alone several levels under Grand Central, whose feet were, quote, matted together at the toes like they were all one part. All you could see was the shape of the top of his toes. Daymuse later says he saw this man running around naked in the tunnels. Daymuse doesn't describe him making any sort of strange noises or communicating with other people, but another informant of Toth's, a homeless man named Jamal, says he found a place called Ghost Cliff, where a tunnel opens up to a ledge overlooking the Harlem River. People live in caves all along that cliff, and Jamal described them this way. They're like little birds. You can hardly see them. They don't talk to each other with words. They use noises that sound like birds, or maybe the wind. This story doesn't totally match up with the other two, as it doesn't describe people living deep underground, nor are train noises and bird noises particularly similar, although I feel like someone who has lived underground around subway trains for years might describe any sort of whistling, humming, honking, hooting sound, any kind of not particularly human sound, as sounding like a train. Still, it is intriguing that there are multiple first-hand stories of people with webbed feet and people communicating with sounds that don't sound like language, living under New York. It could be a sign that such people really exist. Or it could just be a sign that there are rumors about these people that spread pretty fast. Another hard-to-believe anecdote out of Toth's book is one that Toth herself says she witnessed this time. This concerns a man known as Dark Angel, who lives, like many others, in the labyrinth under Grand Central. From the way he's described, both by Toth and the people she interviews, he strikes me as a sort of real-life Candyman. He is universally feared by the people living under New York. He believes himself to be Satan, which could just mean he's schizophrenic, but the striking thing is that other people believe him. Runners from underground communities bring him food simply because they're afraid of what would happen if they didn't. One man claims that he would bring Dark Angel a hot dog from a stand above ground every day. Then one day, when he slacked off and Dark Angel didn't get his hot dog, the man broke his leg jumping a fence. Believing he had been cursed, he limped to Dark Angel's tunnel to apologize, where he found Dark Angel had been waiting for him to show up, seemingly aware he'd broken his leg. A transit police officer told Toth that his CB radio goes dead when he gets near the tunnel where Dark Angel lives. Toth herself records an encounter with Dark Angel, who gives her a remarkably poetic warning about the tunnels. "You have left the world of fairness and good," he allegedly told Toth. "Goodness can no longer reach you down here. You are no longer safe. Leave, little lost angel, before the tunnels swallow you, and you are one of mine." I couldn't help but picture this scene in the original Candyman movie.
"Do I know you?"
"No. No. But you doubted me."
"I'm sorry, I have to go."
"No need to leave yet."
"But I'm late."
"You are not content with the stories, so I was obliged to come."
Which, actually, came out just a year before The Mole People was released, and similarly turns themes of American urban poverty into gothic horror, so make your own conclusions there. One thing that everyone who has encountered Dark Angel remarks on, including Toth, are his eyes. They're red. Red and glowing. Are you doubting Toth yet? Are you beginning to think that maybe she isn't letting the truth get in the way of a good story? A fair number of people were thinking this after reading The Mole People, enough that the book acquired attention from The Straight Dope, a staple site of the early internet. Sharp-eared listeners will note that this isn't the first time I've mentioned The Straight Dope on Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. In my very first episode, before I had learned to fiddle with my recording equipment well enough to get this crisp high definition that you are watching me in now, I brought up the Straight Dope forums because they may have been the first place on the internet where the mysterious quote, "What does it do? That's the beauty of it. It doesn't do anything," was discussed. But the forums aren't the main thing the Straight Dope website, which has been around since the Usenet days of the internet, is known for. The Straight Dope was founded as the longtime home of the 50-year-old Chicago Tribune newspaper column by the same name, which is written by one Cecil Adams, who admits that's not his real name, a bit like Dear Abby, and might be multiple people over time, and uses the tagline, "Fighting ignorance since 1973. It's taken us longer than we thought." In its half century in print and three decades on the web, The Straight Dope has stuck to the same format. A reader sends in a question about a common misconception or urban legends, usually along the lines of, "Does this thing really exist? Where did this come from?" And Cecil Adams answers it with equally heaping doses of in-depth research and snark. The 90s were probably the height of The Straight Dope's popularity. The column was being syndicated to newspapers across the country, and online it was one of the first sites to debunk internet misinformation. So, naturally, after The Mole People was released, it didn't take long for someone to decide to contact Cecil Adams about it. In response to a reader's question, "Are there really mole people living under the streets of New York City?" Adams talked to Toth and found her convincing. While he admitted it was difficult to picture a young, middle-class British woman working for a West Coast newspaper, spending months in such an unfamiliar and hostile environment, and managing to gain enough trust for people to spill their life stories to her, Cecil said she avoided harm by knowing the right people. Cecil also drew on documentation of tunnel people from other sources other than Toth's book, which I'll get to later on. His verdict was essentially that, heaven help us, it's all real. But others disagreed. Perhaps the most famous takedown of Toth's mole people stories came from Joseph Brennan, a New York subway expert. He wrote a massive essay on his early internet blog called Fantasy in the Mole People that went through the book page by page, pointing out inaccuracies, eventually arriving at the conclusion that, quote, every fact in this book I can verify independently is wrong. Sure, Brennan admitted he didn't know enough about homelessness in New York to call BS on Toth's claims of people living in the tunnels, and said that people probably do live in some places under New York. But Brennan knew enough about the tunnels in New York, where they were, when they were dug, what they were used for, etc., that he was able to expose Toth as having fabricated almost everything she wrote about the tunnels themselves, which doesn't bode well for the rest of the book's accuracy. The one error Brennan says that Toth consistently makes is overestimating just how many tunnels there are. It takes a lot of time, effort, and money to build a tunnel, and it's very unlikely that there are many tunnels under New York that were simply built without fanfare and then unceremoniously forgotten. Every abandoned tunnel under New York, Brennan says, was used at some point and appears on at least some map. There simply aren't unknown, undiscovered tunnels full of people under the city that aren't in engineering blueprints like Toth claims, and even the tunnels that do exist don't have enough connections between them to be home to communicating networks of people. For much of the city's history, New York has effectively had three separate subway systems built by three separate private companies in the early 20th century. And while the entire system is operated by a single transit authority today, the tunnels dug by the Interborough Rapid Transit don't often connect to the tunnels dug by the Brooklyn-Manhattan Transit or the Independent Subway System, let alone the commuter and freight rail tunnels that carry completely different types of train. Brennan knocks Toth for her repeated use of the phrase seven levels, which I noticed too. She says that all the time. It's seven levels this, seven levels that. Grand Central is said to extend seven levels down. Elsewhere, it's said to describe the entire subway system. She seems to think that all of New York is one big seven-layer bar. The only way this could be taken as accurate, Brennan says, is as a rough measure of depth, seven stories down, which is defensible. Some of the deepest subway lines in the city are about as deep as a seven-story building is tall, but Toth constantly uses it to imply seven levels of tunnels themselves, each with train tracks in them and most of the levels abandoned. This does not exist anywhere in New York, says Brennan. Grand Central can sort of be said to have seven levels if you count the above-ground levels of the station building, which contain stores, restaurants, and waiting rooms, but only five of those levels are underground, only four of them have train tracks in them, and only one of them is abandoned, a single tunnel formerly used for transporting baggage, which isn't big enough to house a community of people. After the two deep underground levels of the Long Island Railroad Terminal at Grand Central opened in 2022, there are now four underground levels of train platforms at Grand Central, but that project hadn't even started construction yet when Toth wrote her book, or when Brennan wrote his rebuttal to it. Oh, and those complete blueprints of the tunnels in Grand Central that Toth says don't exist? Brennan names several books that include complete blueprints, as well as websites where they can be found. The construction of the Long Island Railroad Terminal, which happened in the 2010s and 20s, also implies Toth's claim is wrong, if nobody knew how deep the tunnels extend under Grand Central, the state of New York probably wouldn't want to risk spending billions of dollars to excavate a new terminal under the existing platforms. But what about the natural caverns where Toth claims people live? If the human-made tunnels Toth describes don't exist, might the caverns exist? Nope, says Brennan. No natural cave has ever been found in Manhattan. The city is built on a hard metamorphic rock known as schist. Get your laughs out now, folks. It's not totally impossible for caves to be naturally carved in schist, but it's a very hard, difficult to permeate rock, and besides hearsay from Toth's book, there's no evidence of any natural caves in all that schist. Brennan also makes note of Toth's somewhat sloppy journalism throughout the book. Things that could be simple errors, but combined with everything else he discovered about Toth's fabrications, point to bigger issues with the truth. At one point, she describes seeing moonlight penetrating through grates in the ceiling of a tunnel. Moonlight usually isn't even visible at street level in Manhattan. In another passage, Toth says she sees daylight through grates just above her, then, just a page later, climbs up several levels of ladders to get up to the surface, so clearly she was too deep down for there to be grates in the ceiling letting daylight in. The mayor of the village under Grand Central asks Toth to stop taking notes, out of fear the cops will find the community from her descriptions, and she obliges, finding it too dark to write things down anyway, but then she proceeds to record a several pages long conversation she has with the mayor, as well as a detailed description of the surroundings. I don't doubt that there are people with recall this good, especially in journalism, but if her memory is that good, why even bring a notebook in the first place? I found a few oddities in Toth's writing style myself the first time I read The Mole People, which Brennan doesn't comment on. She repeats information all the damn time. It's not just the seven levels thing. Her whole introductory paragraph describing the many layers of tunnels under Grand Central, how many people live where, and how there's no blueprint of everything, blah-de-blah-de-blah, appears almost word for word in three separate chapters. It's like the sex scenes in The Room, except instead of repeating and recycling footage of a vampiric middle-aged man humping a virginal lady's navel, she's repeating and recycling fantastical, way-exaggerated descriptions of Lovecraftian warrens of tunnels. Toth also seems to not know what dreadlocks are, describing people's hair as, quote, reggae style, several times in the book. That's a really minor thing, but I still thought it was funny. But Brennan isn't suggesting Toth made up the entire book from whole cloth, because some of her interview subjects, such as the so-called Lord of the Tunnels Bernard Isaacs and graffiti artist Chris Pape, definitely existed. Pape and Isaacs are the closest thing there is to mole people celebrities. Until the mid-2000s, Isaacs lived in the so-called Freedom Tunnel, a wide mainline heavy rail tunnel, not a subway tunnel, that runs for 2.5 miles under Manhattan's west side. The tunnel, which had been built as an industrial branch for freight trains, was abandoned in 1980, but reactivated for passenger trains in the mid-90s. The period during which there were no trains in the tunnel was the heyday of the community there, over which Isaacs ruled more as a sort of friendly uncle and village elder than the elected subterranean mayors that Toth claims exist elsewhere in the city. Chris Pape, whose graffiti moniker Freedom gave the tunnel its nickname, befriended Isaacs in the early 80s, and although Freedom himself never lived underground, he became a symbol of the tunnels by decorating the tunnel walls with elaborate works of art at Isaacs' request. The people of the Freedom Tunnel have been covered by other media portrayals of the homeless in New York, including New York Times articles from around the same time Toth was writing her book, as well as the feature-length documentaries Dark Days and Voices in the Tunnels, a few shorter-form documentaries, and a book by a Dutch war correspondent simply called Tunnel People, a book that is almost exclusively about the Freedom Tunnel and, unlike Tote's book, has never come under fire for being inaccurate. Isaacs became the public face of the Mole people. Charming, well-spoken, and college-educated, Isaacs loved talking to journalists, seeking to publicize his little underground hideaway, not necessarily in a gimme-shelter, this-is-America-under-capitalism sort of way, but more as a friendly place of refuge, to defuse the alligators and chuds myth of what lies under New York. Even when Amtrak bought the tunnel, after years of abandonment, and restored it to use as a shortcut for their Hudson Valley passenger trains to get to Penn Station, which in the process of doing, they sent hundreds of the tunnel's inhabitants to shelters, often forcibly, Bernard Isaacs soon came back, even as trains were now constantly running through his home. The spacious tunnel had been built to include four tracks, while Amtrak only used two, so Isaacs had plenty of space to set up all the comforts of home, while trains roared by just inches away. Some of his old tunnel mates followed, unable to handle life in New York's chaotic and violent shelter system, because really, who could? Homeless shelters are hell on earth. One man in Tote's book describes witnessing a guy getting stabbed right next to him as he tried to sleep, and unlike most of Tote's book, I don't doubt that. With the city at the time throwing money toward shelters as the purported solution to homelessness, Isaacs and company were lucky to have somewhere else to escape from, an alternative to both the shelters and the streets. Life was rough in the Freedom Tunnel, before and after the reintroduction of trains. The tunnel dwellers made a living by collecting cans and redeeming them for 5 cents, and they ate by figuring out which restaurants in the rich neighborhood overhead threw out the most food. But they had each other. It was so much better than living in a shelter, waiting for a housing voucher that might never come. The more I hear about Bernard Isaacs, the more I like him. He's like a Mole People Mr. Rogers. Here he is in a documentary called End of the Tunnel, not long before his death in a rented apartment in 2014, revisiting the tunnel that had been his home for much of his life.
This place is fascinating. I had my art museum, I had my flower garden, I had a train coming through my living room. Come on, no one lived like me.
Isn't that just so pure? I mean, raise your hand if you wish you had trains running through your living room. I'm raising my hand. I'm not sure I can honestly call the Freedom Tunnel people homeless. I'm not too keen on the present-day buzzword houseless, and I think it's destined to go the way of womxin and misogynoir. But I think I can say with a fair degree of certainty that the subjects of Bernard Isaacs, the benevolent lord of the tunnels, were at home. So, where does that leave us? With one widely corroborated, verifiable account of a semi-organized community of people living in a New York City tunnel. There's so much media coverage of Bernard Isaacs, and so little coverage of anyone else who lived under the streets in New York. As far as I know, there are no accounts of underground-dwelling New Yorkers that don't include some reference to Isaacs. Most of the many documentaries and articles and TV spots about him and his fellow Freedom Tunnel residents imply that the Freedom Tunnel is just one of many places like it. But the only source that claims to reveal details about other places like Freedom Tunnel is Toth's book. The existence of Isaacs and Co., one real community of underground homeless in New York, seems to have provided Toth with a veneer of plausibility to claim there are others. Brennan says Toth tends to describe most tunnels she visits as having angular concrete walls, light filtering in through grates in the street above, and occasional concrete-walled emergency exit tunnels with long climbs up to street level. These characteristics are all rather unique to the Freedom Tunnel. Brennan believes that Toth visited this tunnel, conducted interviews with its residents, where they repeated rumors and urban legends they'd heard about people living elsewhere under the city, and spun it into a semi-fictional account of her visiting these people in these other tunnels. Generalizing the details of each tunnel with stuff she'd observed in her visits to the Freedom Tunnel, without bothering to check if those other tunnels really were similar or even existed. After Straight Dope Readers directed Cecil Adams to Brennan's article, he retracted his initial column on the Mole People, a rarity for him, and ran another column, revisiting the book. Once again, he contacted Toth, asking her how to find a few specific tunnels that Brennan had claimed don't exist. She hedged, saying she didn't remember, despite having visited them several times a week for months. But she put Adams in contact with a woman called Cindy Fletcher, who had lived in the tunnels in the early 90s, although she was not interviewed in Toth's book. Damningly, Fletcher could not corroborate the claims that Toth said she would. Fletcher said she'd never heard of anyone living under a mainline rail station in New York, nor that there were communities with elected mayors, saying, "There are no leaders down there." When it was suggested to her that maybe she just wasn't aware of such communities because they were successful in their attempts at keeping themselves secret, Fletcher said this too was unlikely, and at the very least, there couldn't possibly be an underground shanty town with hot showers. There wouldn't be steam pipes in a subway tunnel. Ultimately, Adams concludes that the basic thesis statement of Toth's book, that there are people living under New York, is correct, but they were probably never as widespread, organized, or weird as Toth claims they were. But there's an asterisk to this. A part of Brennan's detailed critique where it seems like Toth is in the right, and he's the zealot just trying to prove her wrong. Early on in the book, as she summarizes all the hidden places beneath the city where people live, Toth mentions what she refers to as New York's, quote, newest abandoned underground structure, a six-lane stretch of highway built in the late 60s beneath Christie Street, which was almost immediately sealed, abandoned, and forgotten. Brennan's initial response to this was predictably a sort of bah humbug. Tunnels don't get sealed, abandoned, and forgotten immediately after being built. But for a public transit expert, here he showed himself to be surprisingly ignorant of how irrational American infrastructure policy can get. Readers of his blog, mostly otherwise devoted to the history of the New York subway, pointed him to a handful of ancient New York Times articles dating from 1960 to 1964, detailing the construction of this 156-foot boondoggle of a highway tunnel. What future project the tunnel was intended to link to is unclear, but it really was built, and then, just like Toth says, sealed, abandoned, and forgotten. Discovering the existence of a tunnel, even Joseph Brennan, whose knowledge of the New York subway means he might rival Bernard Isaacs for the title Lord of the Tunnels, didn't know about, suggests Toth really did do a lot of research for her book, whether or not she traveled into all these tunnels. And if she surprised Brennan by discovering this tunnel, whether it was by exploring underground or poring through old construction documents, what's to say she didn't discover some other tunnels Brennan didn't know about? Sure, it's just a 156-foot stretch of six-lane highway, probably not that much longer than it is wide. But its existence, to me at least, puts Toth's journalistic integrity in a whole new light. If this highway tunnel exists, who knows? Maybe the bird-like people do, too. That's sort of the last word on the state of the Mole People, as they were in Jennifer Toth's time. It's an unsatisfying conclusion, I know. A bit of a cliffhanger ending. We've gone from the Mole People exist and are weirder than you can imagine, to the Mole People mostly don't exist, all the way back to the very beginning, which was maybe the Mole People exist. You can make up your own headcanons about the Mole People, I guess. Personally, I'm sticking with most of Brennan's story. I think that Toth only ever visited the Freedom Tunnel and interviewed the people there, but I do think she did more research than Brennan gives her credit for on where there are abandoned tunnels under New York. Her speculation that hundreds, if not thousands, of people live in them, though, is just speculation, informed to some extent by wild rumors thrown around by Freedom Tunnel residents and other down-on-their-luck New Yorkers, who have likewise never visited such places. I'm just going to choose to believe that Dark Angel and the web-footed people are things that people told Toth about just to mess with her. And what of the mole people today? Toth was writing in 1993, and New York has twice as many homeless people now as it did then. If the tunnels weren't full of squatters in her times, maybe they are now. I don't think so, though. And the reasons why are, I was going to say complex, but they're not really that. Politically charged, maybe, and difficult to say if they're bad or good. In nearly every way but the housing crisis, New York has improved since The Mole People was written. But that's a really big but. In 1993, New York was still crawling out of a hole of its own, one that it began to fall into in the 1970s. The 70s loom large in the cultural history of New York, and for good reason. Crime was sky high and rising. Thousands were fleeing the city every year, mostly to California and Florida, leaving only those who couldn't afford to leave. The New York Daily News chronicled the city's decline in wittily desperate headlines, when New York teetered on the edge of bankruptcy, and President Gerald Ford refused to give the city a bailout. They famously printed, "Ford to City, drop dead." This decline continued through the 80s and into the 90s, as the city government became so desperate that they pursued a policy of so-called planned shrinkage, redirecting the city's limited funds to the neighborhoods that, in the blunt words of Housing Commissioner Robert Starr, could still be saved. In practice, that meant white neighborhoods. In the rest of the city, subway service was cut, the real reason for the subway system's lack of growth since World War II, schools were closed and consolidated, and even emergency services were limited. Massive fires ripped through buildings in the Bronx, which firefighters ignored. Billy Joel has a great song from around this era called "I've Seen the Lights Go Out on Broadway," where he describes, with only a slight amount of exaggeration, what everyone thought would happen if New York continued on this path. Once everyone who matters in the eyes of the city has moved to Florida, everything's just going to be literally torn down. You could write a similar song today, set in California. New York was only starting to turn its fortunes around when Toth wrote The Mole People. And about then, crime was at an all-time high. A large amount of New York's current housing crisis owes itself, paradoxically, to the reversal of New York's fortunes after its decades of decline. It's only been in my lifetime that New York has again become a place where people want to live. New York has grown by 1 million people since 1990, easily erasing the decline in population from the 70s through the 90s. And of course, in response to people now wanting to move to New York, rents have gone up, leaving thousands of New Yorkers out on the streets. But those who are on the streets probably aren't going under the streets the way they used to, or might have used to, because of another factor in New York's recovery, a very controversial one. The main way in which New York has materially improved since the 90s is the reduction in crime. Crime, both violent and petty, was higher in most big cities in the 90s than it is today, but New York saw an especially precipitous drop, due at least in part to the much criticized practice of broken windows policing. Broken windows policing is sometimes summarized as the idea that people committing minor crimes are the same people committing major crimes, but that isn't quite it. Broken windows policing suggests that visible minor crimes, like graffiti, panhandling, and broken windows, create an atmosphere in which crime is tolerated and encouraged, cracking down on so-called quality of life crimes was theorized to cause more serious crimes to fall as well, since it showed that police were taking crime seriously. As predicted, crime dropped around then, for reasons that we can't be sure are related to changes in policing at all. But the bottom line is, there are statistics that seem to suggest broken windows policing worked. But at what cost? Broken windows policing has been claimed to encourage police brutality, and some of the most shocking recent deaths at the hands of cops have been connected to these crackdowns on small crimes. Whether it has saved New York or damaged it further, the Big Apple likely won't get rid of broken windows policing anytime soon. Either way, the tunnels are now crawling with transit police to an extent that they definitely weren't in the glory days of the Freedom Tunnel. The city is much more motivated to put all homeless people in shelters now, whether or not they want it. The documentary Voices in the Tunnels depicted a few people still living in the Freedom Tunnel circa 2010, but they had to constantly be on the lookout for cops. If there ever was a golden age of New York City's mole people, we have now reached the end of an era. What is the legacy of the book The Mole People? Well, I feel like it's ultimately just another entry in the long list of fictional accounts of mysterious things under New York. One thing it shares with everything else in that micro-genre is a smirking sense of, well, what if? Just like Chud, and just like Gregor the Overlander, it seems to tell the reader, you can't prove this is true, but you sure as hell can't prove it's false. What ruins this is that Toth tries to sell her stories as non-fiction, which invites readers to do just that. But it also reinforces a fear of cities that I don't think people should have. I think it contributes to the sense of New York as some dangerous, unfathomable jungle rather than the home of millions of ordinary people. And in the rest of America, I feel like New York is more often thought of as the former than the latter. It's not. You're way more likely to be the victim of a crime in small town America than you are in New York today. More specifically, the idea of mole people creates a fear of public transit. Even in cities that aren't quite as maligned in the media as New York, people aren't likely to ride the subway or support the construction of a subway if they think subways are where mutated, rat-eating, web-footed people live. Toth may have claimed she was humanizing Manhattan's urban poor, but instead, she portrayed them as literal monsters. I feel like most portrayals of homelessness in the popular media fall into two columns, either stigmatizing it or romanticizing it. Either homeless people are dangerous, drug-addicted, barely human creatures, or they're noble sufferers living purer and freer lives than people in the capitalist world. Toth's portrayal of the mole people swings between both these extremes. And both of those feed into a sort of desperate, defeatist narrative that either homelessness can't be solved or shouldn't be solved. Earlier in this episode, I said that I wasn't too keen on the word houseless. I'm okay with it. I have friends who have struggled with losing their homes before, and some of them prefer houseless because the word homeless conjures images of someone like the people in Toth's book. But I think it's been corrupted to support a sort of Nomadland latte leftist vision of homelessness, where homelessness isn't the tragic consequence of decades of bad housing policy, it's a lifestyle, and those who choose that lifestyle should be respected. I'm reminded of a letter in my once and future hometown newspaper, the Willamette Week in Portland, Oregon, from the 2022 city council election. Joanne Hardesty, a progressive city councilwoman serving an at-large seat, was being challenged by the moderate Renee Gonzalez, whose main platform was that Hardesty was soft on homelessness. The Willamette Week ran a letter from a Gonzalez supporter that struck a chord with me. They said, "There has been a massive failure by leftists in Portland of treating homelessness as a serious issue beyond making the status quo more comfortable for homeless people. It's all complaints about anything the centrists propose, with no actual plans to fix a problem. If you can't even admit it's bad for people to be sleeping on the street or in a public park, then you can't be surprised that most of the city isn't listening to you. On the same page, a letter from a Hardesty supporter went, "Gonzalez's campaign is based on a lie that there's a quick and easy way to end crime and homelessness." I don't think the split between "there are no solutions to homelessness, so let's just live with it," and "actually, homelessness is a problem and we can solve it," is really a left versus center debate. That's just the way it played out in this particular election in Portland. But I know which side I'm on. Books like The Mole People portray homelessness as something intractable, inhabiting a strange space where the right-wing talking point that some people are just fated to be poor because they're too far removed from society intersects with the left-ish, idea-shaped object that homelessness is a legitimate form of self-expression. But there are solutions. Homelessness isn't getting worse in America. It's only getting worse in a few big states. Plenty of America's biggest cities have brought homelessness down to a fraction of what it used to be. Houston, the fourth largest city in the country, has brought homelessness down to half of what it was in 2010, even as most American cities went the other way, and they've mostly done that by making housing more affordable. It's not a coincidence that Houston is the only major city in America without zoning. Now other cities are following its lead, including New York. Slowly but surely, America is moving in the right direction. So, this is probably the story of the Mole People. Beneath the streets of Manhattan's Upper West Side, there was a unique community for a while, surviving and thriving. They weren't victims, because they were making a good life for themselves, but it was the city's responsibility to provide for them, and the city failed. They wouldn't have existed in a better-run city. Some saw them as monsters, others as noble savages, neither of which were correct. People came to gawk at them, ranging from the U.S. Housing Secretary to a young journalist with a rich imagination about what could lie under the rest of the city. To the world, they were the Mole People. To themselves, they were the people.
Want to reach your friends, but they're brave.